The concept of teaching children about stranger danger is deeply ingrained in our societal approach to safety. From a young age, kids are often taught to be wary of unfamiliar individuals as a means of protecting themselves from potential harm. While this message aims to instill a sense of caution, it can inadvertently foster a persistent fear of the unknown well into adulthood. As adults, the lingering effects of this childhood lesson can hinder our ability to comfortably engage with new people and embrace new experiences. Welcome to episode 189 of This Shit Works, a podcast dedicated to all things networking, relationship building, and business development. I'm your host, Julie Brown, speaker, author, and networking coach. And today I am joined by Joe Cohane, author of The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World.
Welcome to This Shit Works, your weekly no-nonsense guide to networking your way to more friends, more adventures, and way more success with your host, Julie Brown. Here we go.
It's remarkable to consider that many of the individuals who now hold significant places in our hearts were once complete strangers. It's a testament to the transformative power of relationships, reminding us that the most meaningful bonds often emerge from unexpected intersections, which is why I am so excited to have Joe here to talk about how we can learn to create more of these intersections by connecting with strangers. Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Julie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm super excited. Let's dive right in. So your book delves into the idea that connecting with strangers can be a transformative experience, which I wholeheartedly agree. What inspired you to explore this topic?
Yeah, that's a big question. I was raised by a family of funeral directors, actually, in Boston. And as I grew up, I watched them and the way they were socially, and basically they just talked to everybody all the time. They were super social. My parents would do things like reach across two tables in a restaurant to make an observation about something someone was eating or wearing or whatever, but they were so adept at it that they were able to do it without freaking people out. And so as a kid, holidays, there would be like strangers over for the 4th of July, someone they met at Dunkin' Donuts or someone they met on a trip or whatever. They were constantly accumulating friends. And it was never mortifying to me. I know it's often horrifying for kids when their parents talk to strangers. You know, mine definitely looked at me funny, and she's 7, when I just chat with people. But it seemed like a really natural and a really healthy way to live. And I got to see the benefits of it, right? Just in the sense of this constant stream of new people entering their lives and new friendships and all that. So I went into journalism when I was younger, and that also is, you know, you're practicing the art of talking to strangers when you're working journalism, because you have to connect with people quickly and you have to be curious and all that. You got to be quick on your feet. But a few years ago, I noticed that while some of my most formative experiences in my life came from talking to strangers, that I had sort of stopped doing it. I was going to bars and I was like looking at my phone, which is an appalling thing to do. I would go to CVS and I would go to the self-checkout line and avoid interacting with the cashier. And I noticed it one day that I had sort of pulled back a little bit and I missed the serendipity that I used to get from just chatting with people. Because if you talk to strangers, you know, obviously in a safe venue, but if you do it the right way, you'll always be surprised at the hidden depths and complexities and idiosyncrasies and all this stuff that people have. So I just started digging in a little bit and trying to figure out why I had pulled back. And more to the point, the benefits, what the benefits are. And from my perspective, a lot of it was the phone, right? Because when you have a phone and you're of a certain privileged class, you can go the rest of your life without ever talking to a stranger again. Right? Like it just removes you from the public. And it's really efficient. And in many ways, I like it. But it takes you out of the game, takes you out of kind of concrete reality a lot, very easily. And the other thing is we had a baby and I was just tired. So I wasn't hanging out as much. When I was tired and just couldn't marshal the energy to initiate these conversations that when I was younger came, you know, fairly easy to me. So that led me down a million different rabbit holes of research, looking into, you know, why we don't talk to strangers, when will we, and how can we get good at it, and what the long-term benefits are for us.
I have a couple follow-up questions. you mentioned that you came from a family of funeral directors. Do you think that being around people all of the time who had lost people made your family more just see the value in building relationships and the people around you because they were constantly around somebody's loss?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it gives you a sense. I worked in the business for a while, too. It gives you a sense that the clock is ticking, for one thing, right? So you don't really take life for granted when you're surrounded by death a lot. I think in the case of my family, it made everyone very funny. And I don't know if you've had like experience with funeral directors, but they're really funny people in the same way that cops are often really funny people. And ER nurses are often really funny people. People who work in really extreme situations tend to develop a really good sense of humor to cope with the darkness of what they're seeing every day. So they certainly had that. But I mean, I think, you know, to the point here, when you work in that business, reality avoidance is not an option, right? Like you are in it every day. It's a very social business. You're interacting face to face with people every day. There's no working from home when you're a funeral director. Like you are in the company of other people. You're in the company of many different types of people from many different backgrounds, many different persuasions, and you have to connect with them in order to serve them in the way that, you know, they expect and they deserve. So I think that made everybody pretty deft socially. And I think that probably helped a lot too.
So another thing you said in that first answer was talking to strangers, talking to people at the checkout or in the coffee shop or whatever. And you said you can have really good conversations if you do it in the right way. What did you mean by do it in the right way?
Yeah. So this is a big part of the book where I set out to basically rebuild myself as a very social person. And in order to do that, I wanted to start from zero. I wanted the book to be useful to someone who didn't have a background in this, who might have been, you know, intensely socially anxious, who might be shy, might be more introverted, and just to explain how these interactions work on like a molecular level, right? All the moving parts of these interactions, and there are a lot, but also the skills that you can build in order to get better at it and get more comfortable at. And obviously the big thing is going to be safety. So do it in a place where there are people around. You know, I'm very well aware of the advantage I have as like a 6 foot tall white guy in the realm of personal safety, but for people who might feel less safe generally, to find the right place to do it. Interestingly, a lot of the people I spoke to gather tips on how to do this well identified as introverts, and most of them were women, which is interesting to me. So I would ask them how they do it, how they can practice this and still feel safe at the same time. And they would generally just say, don't do it in bars, right? Because your intention is going to be misunderstood, but do it, you know, in broad daylight when there are people around, when you can feel more comfortable doing it. You're not doing it when you're all alone in a darkened place, you know? But once you find the places that are going to be, that you're going to feel safe doing it, it's a question of just noticing and listening. Ironically, the key to talking to strangers is to not talk to strangers. It's to listen to what they're saying and to notice things. So if you're both experiencing the same thing at the same time, making an observation about it, if there's something about them that's interesting, respectfully ask a question about it and then make it clear that your intention is not untoward, that you're, you know, like, I like your glasses. I'm in the market for a pair of glasses too. Do you mind if I asked you where I got them? Those sorts of things, exercising those muscles is really important. You know, getting back into the habit of making eye contact is a very difficult thing for people. So I took a class with a woman named Georgie Nightingale in England, who runs an organization called Trigger Conversations. And she literally teaches classes on talking to strangers, and she's brilliant at it. She basically starts from zero. So to get people comfortable to talking to strangers doesn't mean go into a Starbucks and initiate an intense philosophical conversation with the barista. It means you have to start easy. You have to get used to like the building blocks as you go, the fundamental skills. So that would be eye contact. And so what Georgie taught the class was just get used to making eye contact. And again, like not leering at people or glaring at people, right? Like under, you know, be aware of yourself. But when you're walking down the street, make eye contact with somebody and just see how it feels to you and see how it goes. When you're buying something at a store, make eye contact with the cashier. You'd be shocked how rare it is that people actually do this. And then see how they respond and kind of monitor your reaction to it. And then you can build from there. You can say good morning to someone when you walk by them on the sidewalk, make a little eye contact, say good morning, and then just watch how they respond. And you get more comfortable with it. And by and large, you're pleasantly surprised by people's response. And then there are some great tips that Georgie had. Like, say you are in the supermarket, right? And you get to the cash register and the person at the cash register says, how you doing? you know, everybody does the same thing. Everyone follows a script. Fine. How are you? Right. You don't put any thought into it. You're not actually listening. You're not engaged. They don't really care. It's just, you know, this is something that humans invented because it would be weird to not say anything to each other. Though often they don't say anything to each other. But when you're in a situation like that and someone asks you a question, actually answer the question. So if someone says, how are you doing today? You can actually answer that. You don't want to go on and on about how, like, there's a thing growing on your neck or, you know, don't get weird with it. Yeah, but you can actually answer it. And a really cool trick that Georgie came up with was give a numerical answer. So if someone says, how are you doing today? You can just be like, you know, 6 out of 10. How are you? And it's amazing what that does when you respond that way in these situations. People will actually light up because now something different is happening. Like, you're actually engaged, you're actually paying attention. And you've also created a frame that allows them to respond in a comfortable way too. And what generally happens when you do that, you say, how are you? And they'll give you a numerical answer back. And now you're like, you know, you have a little, you're playing a little game here. And then you can, you know, Georgie will say, well, if you're a 7 out of 10, what would it take to make you an 8 out of 10 today? And then maybe someone tells you a little bit about their life. Like, these things don't have to take a long time. They can just take the amount of time it takes to buy something in a store. But it's remarkable what people will tell you and, like, the possibilities for these little connections. And sometimes they're really funny and sometimes they're poignant. You know, like, a thing that I started doing, particularly after the pandemic, was I would ask people if, like, people in service positions, if people are behaving themselves today. So if you're in, like, a Dunkin' Donuts and you say, you know, how are you doing? They'll be like, fine. And then you say, people behaving themselves today? And the stories you get are harrowing and hilarious.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's good for you because you're getting a little bit of connection, but it's good for them because someone is actually empathizing with a very difficult job, which is working in service post-pandemic. Like, people just get beaten on in those jobs. But anyways, I suggested people do that. And then my oldest friend went to a Dunkin' Donuts in Massachusetts and asked the clerk if people were behaving themselves today. And she just started crying. And so he called me and he was like, you made me make a woman cry at Dunkin' Donuts.
You can make that person to make them cry. But everybody who came before who misbehaved made that woman cry.
I know, exactly. but those, you know, it's like, you don't get ambitious with it right out of the gate. Just go for these little, you want a little exchange, right? Like you feel comfortable with it. You learn something. Someone feels seen and you feel that you have a little connection with someone. You know, I had to go back to a supermarket. I remember buying groceries one morning and there was, like, a teenage girl working there. And she was like, you asked me how I was doing. And I was like, honestly, I'm beat today. My kid kept us up all night last night. We're exhausted. And she goes, how old is she? I was like, she's 3. And she goes, well, I have a little sister too. It gets better. And this is, like, a teenager, you know? And now what could have that interaction could have just been me not saying anything and her not saying anything. But instead, it ended up being, like, a little connection. And I got to see a depth of empathy in a teenager. And you know, and we had a little chat. It was cool. Again, not doesn't have to be profound. It just has to be that. And once you get comfortable with that sort of level of interaction, then, you know, and the situation allows for it. You can't launch into, like, a deep philosophical conversation with someone who's busy. Don't make a nuisance of yourself. But you learn to read people a little bit better. You learn to follow your curiosity. You get a little quicker on your feet. You learn to navigate these very complicated interactions. And when you do, there's actually a growing body of research now on the benefits of talking to strangers, what they call minimal social interactions, which are small, little passing interactions with the guy at the gas station, the woman at the coffee shop, whatever it is. This has been led by psychologists Nicholas Epley, Juliana Schroeder, and Jillian Sandstrom. And they've done a lot of experiments now, and a lot of these findings have been replicated in other countries by other researchers as well, that find that when people talk to strangers, they come away from the experience feeling more connected to their communities, feeling a stronger sense of belonging, less lonely, more hopeful. You know, long-term effects can be depolarization. It can be a reduction of prejudice. All these things that happen as the result of deeper, meaningful connections with people who are different than we are. There are tons and tons of benefits of this. And at a time when loneliness is at epidemic levels and people feel estranged and they feel angry and they feel that they're not being listened to, and they're not really leaving their houses quite as much as previous generations, these are really important things. I was reading the other day that they're talking about using ketamine to treat loneliness, which is, I'm glad that they're figuring something out because loneliness has very dire physical consequences. Right. But the solution to loneliness, the cure for loneliness, is just other people. Like, we are surrounded by potential treatments for loneliness. we have just, in many cases, lost the skills to initiate those connections and make those friends.
Right. Yeah. So you actually answered what was going to be my next question, which was, so these, this like 6 out of 10 thing, when you, somebody asks, how are you? We would probably put this under the umbrella of small talk. And people probably don't think that there's a profound effect to small talk, but your book says that there is well-being benefits to these, as you're saying, minimal social interactions, this small talk that we have with strangers. So if we could do that more every single day, then it would only lend to the idea that we'd be, our well-being would be enhanced.
Sure, yeah. Small talk's funny because it gets a bad rap because mainly people don't understand what it is. I went pretty deep on the anthropological research of how like humanity learned to live among strangers. And one of the key innovations that human societies came up with were things called greeting rituals. So there's a thing called, So one of the innovations that human society came up with in order to deal with the reality of strangers is these greeting rituals, which were just like ritualized ways to make a stranger feel safe, to recognize that we're in the same space, to deal with sort of the possibility of threat coming from the stranger versus the possibility of opportunity coming from the stranger, and to reconcile those things into a structured way that allows us to meet other people, meet new people, work with other people, and communicate with other people. Now, in traditional societies, these are much more elaborate. They involve a series of stages that the stranger has to be brought across in order to show that they're not murderous and they're not agents of chaos and all this stuff. But we have evidence of these throughout modern society too. A handshake is a greeting ritual, right? A handshake is showing that you can you can make physical contact with someone and they're not going to attack you. And small talk is another version of these where the function of small talk is not to be the conversation. And that's why people hate small talk so much, is that you get stuck in small talk and you can't get out of it. And it's boring and it's miserable and makes you want to leave. What it really is that it's a greeting ritual. It's a way of establishing that you're in the same space, that you can safely talk to each other, that you're experiencing the same reality, right? That you're not chaotic. It's a way to normalize yourself in the presence of another person. And then once you do that, once you connect with the person, once you've established that you can talk safely, then you can move on to something else. Now, if you're at a cocktail party, like, what do? That question, right? That's a bonding ritual. It's a way of like, can I talk to this person? Do I feel comfortable with this person? But if you get stuck in what do you do conversations forever, it's like death. It's the worst. So basically, it's the beginning of the conversation. And from there, once you feel that you can talk, then it's a question of listening. It's a question of asking good open-ended questions like who, what, where, when. It's a matter of not just steering the conversation into something that you're personally interested in, or do the thing everyone does, which is like, how can I get this back to me? It's like travel, right? So when you're really talking to someone you've never met before, it gives you the opportunity to explore their experience. And the only way you can do that is having an open mind. So when they say, this is what I do for work, you don't just say, oh, that's interesting. Here's what I do for work, because that's what kills the conversation. You ask questions about that. How did you end up doing that? Do you like doing it? Exactly. If you could do anything, would you do that? Would you do something else?
I always ask, is that what you wanted to do when you were a kid?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Because it's generally not. Very rarely are they doing what their childhood wanted to do.
Yeah, did your childhood dreams die when you took this job? There's a guy named Paul Ford who's a tech CEO and a writer, and he does this thing when he's at a party where he'll ask someone what they do, and then they'll like, you know, someone asks you that question and you already want to leave, right? It's such a dead question.
Oh, it's been scientifically proven that it is the most hated question.
Sucks.
Scientifically
but
proven.
But if you ask it as an opener, and then what Paul would do is they would tell him what they do, and he would say, geez, that sounds really hard. And then you would get like the whole person once you do that, right? I think if you ask people about their, you know, what they wanted to be as a kid, you'll get much more of the person. And then it gets much more interesting. And then from there, it's a dance where they've disclosed something a little personal to you. You make a match disclosure of something a little personal too, and you're kind of following each other. And then sometimes you end up in really amazing conversations with people if you have the time to spend together. But you have to be aware of all these different parts of the conversation in order to get good at it. That's what I tried to do with the book.
What do you think, you know, what is the balance between technology or digital and personal interactions? We mentioned our phone is probably the biggest culprit. It's also sort of the advancement of technology within stores, like you mentioned self-checkout, which I usually do because I'm just like, I just got to get out of here. I don't want to wait in line, you know? So how do we balance the fact that we are not going to go backwards as far as a society and our dependence on technology? So how do we balance that going forward, knowing that we do desperately need these interactions?
Yeah, I mean, we're hyper social beings, and social contact keeps us healthy. Like, that's the baseline thing to understand, is that you can't go without it. And I know that social contact with friends, with strangers, with family, whoever, they can be fraught. There can be friction involved. It can take energy. Sometimes you have to travel to do it. Like, there's effort involved. And I think the other thing, as humans, like, we tend to gravitate towards efficiency and ease in a lot of ways. So when given the opportunity to completely withdraw from in-person human interactions, like, we'll do it because it's easier. Yeah. And there's an evolutionary reason why we default, why we will go for easier things. It saves energy. It drains fewer resources in terms of the food you have to eat, the calories you burn, and everything else. But we have evolved in such a way that we require real connection, or else we start to fall apart. We fall apart mentally and we fall apart physically. So I think the first thing you need to understand is this is not like a fun thing to do. This is a question of health. It's a question of nutrition. Mm-hmm. Like, I think of it in terms of like your social diet, right? So your main forms, your main sources of nourishment are going to be friends and family, hopefully, if you have healthy relationships with your friends and family. But then also just interacting with the people you meet on a daily basis, that's also nourishing. That's also nutrition. And if those people become friends, then that's great, right? Then that works a lot better. And so I think you need to understand what you need psychologically and what you need physically in order to be a healthy human. And social interaction is a huge part of that. Now, can you get that over Zoom? A little bit, but it's a little harder because it's like a low fidelity connection that you get through Zoom. A little research showing that, yes, sometimes if you have a very good conversation on a digital platform, it can have some of the same effects that it does in real life, but it's not the same. You're not getting the full person. It's a little more two-dimensional. So I think people do need to take the initiative. But at the same time, like, I love texting. A lot of this stuff, it definitely makes life easier, but I know I don't feel great when I do only this for a long time. I know that I do need to go out and just have a conversation with someone just to remind myself both that it's doable, to kind of refill the tank, and also just to honestly feel a little bit better about humanity. You know, this is a bit of a side point, but, and I didn't put this in the book, I didn't realize it until later, but when you get all your data about what humanity is from social media, from the media, and I say this as like someone who's in the media for a long time, you are going to get an overwhelmingly negative view of humanity, right? So if you're only reading the newspaper, you're only, you know, reading online publications, you're going through Twitter, whatever. Much of what that's going to tell you is that people are horrible, because the incentives are that people are horrible on these things. And so it ends up being really reassuring to go out to the world and find that you can communicate with someone you haven't met, and that person is interesting, and that person is kind, and that person is curious, all that stuff. It's a way to counteract the pessimism that you get from an overwhelmingly digital media diet. And I think everyone I talk to who does this, who wants to do it, has reported back like a similar thing, just being like, I felt really lousy about people. And then I went out and I just had a nice conversation with somebody and I feel a little bit better about it. Because we generalize from our interactions, right? You have one really good interaction and you feel better about people, and you have one bad interaction and you feel worse about people. So you need to be aware of that, of using this to maintain a healthier and more balanced perspective about what people are. And people can be terrible, no question about it. But my experience is that just getting out there and talking to people makes me feel a lot better about the species, I guess.
Yeah. Do you have one story that someone's shared with you that you're like, yes, that's an amazing stranger intersection story?
Yeah, this didn't make the book because it was such a long and complicated story that my editor wouldn't let me put it in there. But I was actually talking to this guy yesterday. I was in Boston and I was getting a taxi back to the train station like early one morning to go back to New York where I live. And the Lyft driver shows up and he had a dish of Starburst in his car. And so, you know, it's just like Starburst. I haven't seen these in a while. And he was like, yeah, you know, I tried hard candy and no one wanted it. And I tried some other stuff. And it seems like Starburst is the thing that people are really interested in this. And so we started talking and he ended up being one of the most interesting people I've ever met. And we're to this day, we're still friends. But he was born female, identified as male, had a horrendous childhood in the South, lived all over the country, super smart, really interesting, really charismatic. ended up going to Smith College at like 45 to study public health, ended up in Uganda. While in Uganda, locked eyes one day in a village called Gulu with a kid who was covered with burns. Like 60% of his body was covered with burns. I think he was 10 years old when Jay met him. And they had this profound connection. And from that point, Jay decided that he was going to try to get this kid the medical care he needed. Because if you get that burned at a young age, like you'll die. Your skin doesn't stretch, doesn't grow. So you need serious medical treatment. So Jay spent 10 years of his life trying to get this kid the help that he needed in order to survive. And just had this incredible story of like everything they went through together, really remarkable. And that all came from me noticing that he had Starburst in the car. And it was such a great conversation. You know, we rode in the car for 15 minutes and I got, you know, he told me about a lot of that. And then I called him and we ended up talking more and now we're pals. But I got to experience that, you know, which is a wildlife story. I also met him in the middle of his transition. And so I couldn't say that I had any transgendered friends. And so it was interesting meeting someone because now I have an understanding of what the issues are like there, what the difficulties are like and what the struggles and the unintended sources of comedy are in this. Like, he was just a fascinating person. And also just like, you know, good guy to talk to. So I think that was probably my favorite. I put a lot of interactions in the book that were just kind of passing interactions that ended up being quite profound interactions on the subway, which you're not supposed to do. But those turned out, you know, pretty remarkable in some ways.
What do you mean you're not supposed to?
Nobody's supposed to talk to strangers in the subway. Kidding me?
Really?
That's like one of the big social norms. So one of the things that keeps people from doing this is like the idea that you're not supposed to, right? And subways are one of the places that people feel least comfortable talking to strangers. I think because it's so crowded and everyone's very aware that everyone else is like busy and trying to get their quiet time in. But there's been a number of pretty big studies on this where psychologists sent people out to initiate conversations with strangers on mass transit. And every single one of them going out is like, this is a disaster. People are going to think I'm nuts. Someone's going to attack me. Yeah. They were overwhelmingly pessimistic about how it was going to go. And then they did it. And it was unanimous, like literally unanimously positive. These participants were men and women across a multitude of ages. And there wasn't a single one who had a bad experience. So it's pretty amazing. But there is like, there's this idea that you're not supposed to do it. And we have a very hard time violating social norms as humans.
Is that newer? Can I ask a clarifying question? I don't take the subway anymore. I haven't taken the subway or the T because I was in Boston. I haven't taken the T regularly since I started my business 8 years ago because now I just drive to my office. But when I did take the T, I was so curious about people on the train, what they were reading, where they were, you know, like I would always talk to people on the train. Is that a newer social norm or did I just always buck the system?
I think you always buck the system. And I think there's people with a certain approach and a certain energy who can get away with a lot of this. And my idea is that having learned about this and having practiced it a lot, you can get to the place where you can just violate all these social norms at ease and people are comfortable with it. It becomes problematic if I'm like sweating, trying to talk to someone on the train, you know, like making me nervous, I'll make them nervous. But if you're confident, you're comfortable and you're respectful, you can pull it off. Again, the woman, Georgie Nightingale in England, she got so good at it. She's a genius at this stuff, but she would get on the train, the tube in London and see a man wearing a hat and just point to him and go, hat. And that would be enough to start a conversation. Like she had like this way about her that made it very easy to do this. But yeah, I think in a lot of cases, especially in London, like it's a huge no-no. You can just Google it and people are horrified at the prospect of talking to people on the tube.
Good. I had no idea. But I'm also fascinated by strangers. So I feel like anytime I can talk to a stranger, I'm happy. So as we wrap up, which I don't want to because I could talk about this all day long. Do you have one thing that the listeners could just do today to start doing this in their daily life?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say, so when you're just in your day-to-day interactions with a waiter at a restaurant, with a cashier, ask them how they're doing, but see if you can get a real answer. Like show actual curiosity. And I think it's a good place to practice because it's a finite interaction. It's not going to go on forever. There's no chance that you're going to get stuck there for an hour. It's just a quick interaction, but it's a way to, you know, to use like an exercise metaphor, it's like a way to get your reps in. But I think more importantly, those jobs are so shitty now. People are so nasty to these people that just being more human around them and showing that you see them as human beings, as equals, and that you're actually interested. And, you know, you, again, you have to mind yourself a little bit. Don't go in there and just roll in and ask a super personal question. But just aim for a little bit of connection, right? And you'll come away feeling better and you'll get better at it as a result. But like more to the point, their day will be a little bit easier. And I think it's just like a kindness that people need to relearn again. I feel like we forgot how to be humans to a pretty serious degree during the pandemic. And we need to rebuild those muscles. We need to treat people like humans and not robots that are exist to serve us.
All right, Joe. Joe, this was great. Julie. You're not a stranger to me anymore. You were before this, but not anymore. Thanks so much for joining
us. Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
There were so many great takeaways from this episode, but I think my nugget that I'm going to be coming away with and keep in my back pocket is that small talk is a greeting ritual. It's like a handshake. Make sure it's quick and use it as a way to engage in a deeper conversation. I hope Joe has helped everyone come away with a newfound appreciation for the potential in every encounter, or perhaps a reminder of the power of human connection that emerges when we step beyond our comfort zones, even if it's just a little itsy, bitsy, you know, piece beyond our comfort zones. Remember, every stranger is a potential friend, a source of inspiration, or a gateway to a new perspective, or maybe just a way to brighten your day for a couple of minutes. By embracing the power of strangers, we can enrich our lives, broaden our perspectives, and contribute to the creation of a more connected and compassionate world. All right, friends, on to the drink of the week, which, can you believe it, there is a cocktail called Stranger Danger. Of course there is. There's a cocktail for everything. It comes to us from the folks at Imbibe Magazine. Here's what you're going to need. 1.5 ounces of Pisco, 1/2 ounce of Mezcal, 1 ounce orange cream soda syrup. I'm going to give you the recipe for that. 1 ounce of fresh lemon juice, 3/4 ounce of aquafaba, or 1 egg white. Now, don't get freaked out. I drink cocktails with egg whites all the time, and I've never had an adverse reaction from the raw egg. So, that orange cream soda syrup, here's the recipe. This is obviously for a batch of it, for a big batch, so you could half it or quarter it as you need. So here's the recipe for that. Combine 45 ounces of Sunkist with 45 ounces of sugar, because, you know, simple syrup is usually 1-to-1. 2 ounces of vanilla extract in a saucepan over medium-high heat. Bring to almost a boil. Stir regularly, then let simmer on low heat for 10 to 15 minutes. Take off of the heat and let cool, and then store in the refrigerator for up to a month. Like I said, this is for a big batch, so break it down as you see. It's usually just 1-to-1, so if you have a cup of Sunkist, use a cup of sugar. Get it? And then obviously bring down the vanilla. Okay, so after you have that simple syrup made, this is what you're going to do for the cocktail. You're going to combine all of the ingredients in a shaker, then dry shake, so no ice, for a minute. And then add ice and shake for 30 more seconds. Double strain into a coupe glass. All right, friends. That was a more complicated cocktail than I normally give. Let me know if you make it. All right, friends. That's all for this week. If you like what you heard today, of course, please leave a review and subscribe to the podcast. Also, please remember to share the podcast to help it reach a larger audience. If you want more Julie Brown, you can find my book, This Shit Works, on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You can find me on LinkedIn at Julie Brown BD. Just let me know where you found me when you reach out. I am JulieBrown_BD on the Instagram, or you can just pop on over to my website, juliebrownbd.com. Until next week, cheers.
Hey, thanks for taking the time to listen. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss a tip. And remember, you can unapologetically be who you authentically are and still be wildly successful. That's a fact. See you next week on This Shit Works.